Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we Zoom on Thursday morning, so if something should happen Thursday night, the last night of the Republican convention, we will not be discussing it. And of course, we'll just be talking a little bit about this hurricane because it already has hit. Now the question is, how much damage has it done? But I'm sure Scott Braddock, our first guest, will be able to give us some information. Before we do that, we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We believe that the voice of an immigrant, the voice of a patriot, and the voice of someone who's willing to talk truth to power is important for you to have in your head as you exercise the franchise during the election of 2020. Now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I will be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And I believe because he is in Austin, you weren't hit by the hurricane, were you?
No, not at all. And most of Texas dodged the whole thing just in the last few days. And this is how fast all this can happen. And I've seen it over the years, Arnie. I was reflecting on social media and talking with folks who were there at the time about Hurricanes Katrina and Hurricane Rita years ago in Houston, going back 15 years ago, 2005. And I was remembering working the news desk, KTRH in Houston, and the advisory that just sort of stunned everyone all along the Gulf Coast about Hurricane Katrina included words that I had never seen from the National Weather Service. And you know, when those forecasters, when the meteorologists, when they put things together, they usually like to use language that will later let them say, well, we were just telling you what might happen, right? We were just kind of giving you the worst case scenario so that you will be prepared. And listen, those people do yeoman's work. And we have some of the best meteorologists in the country and in the world, frankly, in Houston, because we're a big hurricane-prone area on the Gulf Coast. They're on the third coast, the blue-collar coast. Let me tell you, there's some people who are hurting today in Louisiana, in Cameron, Louisiana, which is probably part of the Gulf of Mexico this morning, in Baton Rouge, in Lafayette, and I think as you and I talk, up in Shreveport, which is northwest Louisiana, they are getting ready to get the brunt of the storm because this thing is held together. Usually when hurricanes come on shore, they break up, right? In the water is where they gain strength over the warm water. And of course, I know what you'll say. That's why we talk about climate change. It's one of the big factors. And as we've talked about many times in the past on this show, and others have talked about, the issue with climate change and hurricanes is not necessarily that you get more of them. It's that you get stronger ones. We were already seeing that 15 years ago with Katrina and Rita, monster storm. So when that advisory came across my desk at KTRH in Houston, it included the words certain death, which I've never seen that before or since in a National Weather Service advisory. And of course, we know what happened. Almost 2,000 people were killed by Hurricane Katrina. And this storm, Hurricane Laura, came together, in the last 72 hours, just in an incredible way. It actually hit the Gulf Coast as a stronger storm than Katrina. Katrina was a Category 3 hurricane when it made landfall. Laura was almost up to a Cat 5 in strength. And when we talk about the categories, that only speaks to wind strength. When you're talking about a hurricane, they're not all made the same, Arnie. 3 years ago, we had Hurricane Harvey. which was more of a rain event. You might remember it came ashore.
It never stopped raining.
It just never stopped.
That was the problem with Harvey.
It just never stopped raining. It may be counterintuitive to people who aren't familiar with this stuff, but if a hurricane is moving quickly, that's good. That's better than one that stops and just wreaks havoc in one area and just stalls out and just stays there, which is what Harvey did. And you've heard the president talk about the way Harvey would keep going into the Gulf of Mexico and it kept coming back into Houston, which is exactly what happened. And you saw terrible flooding. We're seeing that today with Laura, although I do think that it's something where national media is going to move on fairly quickly. The communities that I named that were impacted by Laura overnight, not big cities. These are smaller places in Louisiana. Of course, people in Texas will be ready to help. I just got a notice that Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Patrick, and some others are going to go out to East Texas to the part of the state called the Golden Triangle, which is where Beaumont and Port Arthur, that's where they are down on the coast. And they're going to check out Orange County and Jefferson County. Those are two areas that have seen some impact. And we do have some people without power in the southeast corner of the state, again, what they call the Golden Triangle. But we don't see a lot of people who were hurt. We don't see too much in the way of damage in Texas because most of this was in Louisiana. I do want to say I was texting, and this is how it's all so unpredictable. I was thinking about not just Hurricane Katrina, but also Rita, which I mentioned. A lot of people don't remember Hurricane Rita at all. It came in the week after Hurricane Katrina had decimated New Orleans. And Hurricane Rita was also a very powerful storm that was pointed right at Houston. And at that time, about 3 million Texans evacuated southeast Texas. They all left Houston. I was a young reporter, 25 years old, walking along I-45 north out of Houston toward Dallas, walking along the cars that were stopped. There was bumper-to-bumper traffic from Dallas to Galveston, which if there was no traffic, it was a drive that would take you about 7 hours to make. And so this was a huge undertaking trying to move all these people out. And what happens is hurricane fatigue, Arnie, this is what happens. People had just seen what had happened with Katrina. And so they were ready to move and get out of there in Houston when they thought it was going to hit. Well, Rita did change course right before it hit Texas. And it went in much the same places that Hurricane Laura went, although some of the places in Texas and East Texas that were hit. And I remember talking to an elderly gentleman who was at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, which had been converted to a hurricane shelter at the time, right after Rita came ashore. He had been evacuated to Lufkin, Texas, where, according to the forecast, it looked like they were going to be fine there. And that's actually where the hurricane had turned and gone to Lufkin. So he was very frustrated by that, of course. But all these folks do the best that they can. I can imagine that people on the Gulf Coast right now are really suffering. A friend of mine who was in Beaumont was getting his family out of the area. His wife and children had left days ago. Mm-hmm. And then yesterday I was texting with this friend of mine who said that he and his dog finally decided they were not going to try to ride it out in Beaumont. So they had gotten a hotel in Houston, you know, which is about an hour to the west of them. But it did give me at least some confidence for my family members who are in Southeast Texas or mainly in the Houston area that my friend was evacuating to Houston. So it seemed like Houston
was a good place
of the storm. But I can tell you, and some experts have talked about the idea that because Houston is home to a giant ship channel and so much petrochemical industry, that if a storm, and this is why it's important going forward, because I think this storm is one of those that's going to be kind of forgotten. There are going to be some people who are suffering in the places that we talked about in Louisiana and up through Arkansas, and then this thing's going to send rain up y'all's way at some point, Arnie, all the way up to the East Coast.
We're getting it.
The storm itself is going to be forgotten, a lot like Hurricane Rita was 15 years ago, which, believe me, I'll never forget it. But I do think it's a warning for the future. Some experts have said that if a storm that looks and has the same traits as Hurricane Laura was to hit Houston, it would be the Chernobyl of the United States because it would be ripping apart all that petrochemical industry there. You would see so many people suffering for so long, and add to the mix the fact that you would have all these chemicals being pushed into that populated area. A storm that big, Laura, when it was 10 hours away from landfall, it was already pushing the Gulf of Mexico onto land in Texas, so what we call storm surge. In Galveston County yesterday, around lunchtime, we were getting word that there were roads that had water over the roads already. When the storm is 10 hours out, it's not raining there. It's that the Gulf of Mexico is being pushed up onto the land, which is what happens with that storm surge. But a storm that size, and you think about America's Chernobyl, a storm that powerful, it literally turns the Gulf of Mexico over. So the water that was on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico is on the top the very next day because it's mixing Incredible. It as it goes. And you can imagine that with all the chemicals that and you know, the petrochemical situation.
The toxic crew.
And there's petrochemical industry basically from Corpus Christi all the way to Louisiana. So, you know, it's something we have to think about our infrastructure, something we need to think about our planet moving forward and how we take care of it and how we take care of each other.
So a little bit of a comment. So I painfully watched as much as I could of the Trump convention last night. No mention of the fires in California. They did talk about the hurricane. Mm-hmm. They did send, you know, their condolences and their concerns to places like Louisiana and Texas, but no mention of California. If you're not in a place where the fire is, you're breathing in smoke. They've had, a day or two of pretty decent weather, but the fires are just enormous. And the number of houses that have been destroyed is enormous. And it really isn't contained yet. But isn't it interesting? Even in condolences, they look at the politics. So we're not going to offer condolences to California because that's a liberal blue state and they didn't rake the leaves. And then we're going to look at what's going on. And it just, to me, I'm just exhausted because this is misery. And misery has no political label.
No.
It's just frightening and depressing.
It has no political label. And, you know, the politics of a hurricane come in the days, weeks, months, and years after the storm comes ashore. Hurricane Harvey, which we mentioned earlier, that was 3 years ago. Can you imagine that, Arnie? So much has happened since then. But, you know, there's still housing that has not been rebuilt after Harvey in the Houston area. In 2005, when Katrina hit, you, of course, remember the pictures of President George W. Bush checking out the damage, you know, from Air Force One, and people wondering why he wasn't on the ground there. And people are always going to question the way that that these responses go. And there's really, I mean, there are certain things that can be done to make a difference, for sure. If you look at what happened in New Orleans, the places that came back are the places where they surged resources. How about that? You know, I mean, the stuff doesn't just happen on its own. It's part of why state and local politics are so important. If you think about the issue with New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina, it was a monster storm, but the city basically withstood the hurricane passing over it. What happened was Katrina dumped so much rain into Lake Pontchartrain, which is just north of New Orleans, and the city is protected by a levee from the lake. New Orleans, as you know, sits below sea level. So when the levees broke, that's when the whole area flooded. And I was in Baytown, Texas, again, as a reporter at KTRH in Houston. And it was about 4:30 in the morning, 4:35 o'clock, something like that. Overnight, we had gotten word that the levees had been breached in New Orleans. And so my job as a young reporter was to go ask all of these folks at this shelter in Baytown, Texas, who had made their way from New Orleans, to go ask them their take on what was going on and get their reaction to what was happening. And I'll never forget, Arnie, there was this little elderly lady in a wheelchair with an oxygen tank. She seemed like she wanted to talk to the guy with the radio microphone. That was me. She came over to me and was asking me if I knew what was going on with New Orleans. And so what I had just learned was that the levees had been breached. And of course, I legitimately didn't know what that would mean for the city. And so we're live on the radio and I asked her the question. I said, what will that mean for New Orleans if the levees break? And the look on her face was just devastated. She said, there won't be no New Orleans.
She's practically right.
And I'll tell you something, Arnie, for some of those neighborhoods, they never came back.
My daughter lived in what was called the sliver by the river. And so she was very lucky because when everything was breached, there was this little tiny sliver by the river that escaped it. And luckily my stepdaughter escaped it. But I'm going to remind everyone, as we're talking about the hurricanes and the devastation and what's going to have to be rebuilt and everything else and the infrastructure, and we're talking about California and what's going to have to be rebuilt because of the fires. And this is not going to be the end. This is the beginning of hurricane season. This is the beginning of fire season.
Yes.
So I just want everyone to know, we're just talking at the beginning of a conversation that's going to continue. And you've heard me say this before, Scott, and I'm going to repeat it again. I went down to help after Katrina because that's where my daughter-in-law lives.
Yeah.
And when we went down there, I remember, I'll never forget it. Historically, it's a very African-American city. All of a sudden, I saw very few African-Americans, but I saw a lot of Hispanics. I heard a lot of Spanish being spoken. And then we went down into the city, and they were selling T-shirts, and the T-shirt said F-E-M-A. Find every Mexican available.
Of course.
I mean, I want everyone to understand that. And as Donald Trump is talking about putting a moat around the wall and shooting people in the legs.
Alligators
Oh my God. It's just, he's the level. I mean, this is
broken glass on the top. It's unbelievable. He has Republican former staffers now coming out and talking about the kinds of things that he said that were so cruel about the way he wanted people to be treated if they were coming across the border.
But I want to remind everyone that when you went down to New Orleans, who rebuilt New Orleans were Hispanics, were people that were both legal and illegal that had come across the border, and they were the ones that were doing the construction. They were the ones that were doing the rebuilding. Even George Bush nodded and allowed construction workers not to ask certain questions of the people they employed in order to rebuild New Orleans. We're going to have to rebuild after this Hurricane Laura. We're going to have to rebuild after California. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Do you understand what Donald Trump is saying and what we actually need as a nation to rebuild?
I think the rest of what you said is a pretty good segue into what was going on at the Republican National Convention, because you do have just a through the looking glass moment going on. If you watched last night, so we're taping here on Thursday, so if you watched on Wednesday, when they were in this almost grotesque way mixing official government actions with a political event. So it was Tuesday and Wednesday when we saw this stuff where the president was at a naturalization ceremony for some immigrants, which is a beautiful thing in and of itself to see a naturalization ceremony. The people who want to be United States citizens and have come in and they're migrating legally. And he also pardoned the guy live there on television. Maybe it was on tape, but these are the things that the president's doing in his official capacity as president. You know, government actions being used in a political event. And I can tell you, people don't really care about separation of powers. People don't really, voters don't really care about, you know, sort of the politicization of the sacred acts of the executive, like a pardon for political purposes. But this is exactly how the system breaks down when somebody has no shame and is willing to use these things as political props for themselves, right? If it's not televised, it's about the people who are there being naturalized or being pardoned. If it's televised, it's about the guy doing the pardoning, right? This is all about, the great leader, if you will. Right? And so that's the way that they're using it. And I can tell you, in watching this this RNC, it's been pretty fascinating to see the screaming of some folks. Kimberly Guilfoyle, did you know that she was married to Gavin Newsom years ago?
No, I did not.
I was kind of taken aback that people didn't know that. So whatever reason, I knew that when they were married. I think it might have been when he was the mayor of San Francisco years ago. But I saw people tweeting out and Facebooking and say, "Did you know that thought that they were married? I just learned this." And I said, "Well, they were together many years ago, and then he had a sex scandal of his own. Newsom did. He's an interesting guy." But there's Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is on stage ostensibly as some conservative commentator. She's the girlfriend, of course, of Donald Trump Jr., and she's just screaming, Arnie, about, you know, all the bad things that are going on in America, and of course, all the bad things are happening while Donald Trump is in the White House, so we should say that. But there was so much anger when we were told this was going to be an uplifting convention. It did include those moments we talked about, like the naturalization ceremony. Then I watched Dan Crenshaw, who's a congressman. He represents one of the most gerrymandered districts in the United States. If you look up Dan Crenshaw's congressional district, you'll see what I mean. It runs all around the suburbs of Houston into the city itself. But his speech was actually uplifting. He was talking about the everyday heroes of America. And it's the kind of people you with the frontline workers, people in the military, nurses, etc. You may have seen what he was talking about there. Did you notice Crenshaw never said Trump's name once? When everything else about this convention has been all about Trump, but not Crenshaw's speech. Here's a guy who they have promoted as a rising star in the Republican Party, somebody who's going to be the fresh face or the new face of the Republican Party. And yet he's not talking about Trump. He's not talking about the illegal immigrant invasion. He's not screaming about the protesters in Wisconsin or Minneapolis or anything like that. Instead, he's just giving this uplifting speech. And I think there are guys like Crenshaw and others who want to be involved in the Republican Party now, but also have an eye toward what the GOP maybe might look like one day when Trump is not around anymore, whether he loses this year or whether he has a second term and goes on and we have four more years of this. But at some point, you know, Crenshaw's a young guy. He's looking forward and saying, you know, at some point we're not going to have this anymore. And it's interesting that you don't see as much of that from other Republicans. We had Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the little gov. He was the one proudly representing Texas during the roll call to nominate President Trump as the GOP nominee. Patrick, who is from Baltimore originally, had said that, you know, President Trump may not have been born in Texas. Fact check, he was not born in Texas. He's a Manhattan developer. But he said that the president was not born in Texas, but today he's Texas' favorite son. I don't know what polling he's looking at to suggest that. You know, right now, everything suggests that Biden is at least competitive in Texas. We'll see what actually happens. I do think that, as we talked about previously on the show, the Republicans are putting together some kind of a plan to once again eke out by the skin of their teeth, you know, a majority vote in Texas this year. It's going to be a tough race. And in looking at the RNC versus the DNC, I don't think that you saw anything that really changes the dynamic of the election going forward. I mean, I think that Democrats probably did a little better job of trying to reach out to people who are not already Democrats and looking to vote for Joe Biden. Republicans, I think, are basically doubling down on who their base is and trying to make their base feel about okay, you know, about who they are by putting so many people of color on stage. You know, right after I had seen so many Democrats just in the last week who had, and not all, but some Democrats who were very upset with their own party saying that there was not enough diversity on stage at the DNC. I didn't agree with that. I mean, I saw when they would do the screen of, you know, 50 different people on the screen, and it would be, you know, every race, creed, religion, everything else. I think that some people meant that their specific preferred candidates were not on stage. I think that's what some people were complaining about. But then the Republicans, I think, went out of their way smartly to show people of color who are Republicans.
Male blacks. Just I want to remind everyone, Donald Trump has looked at the African-American vote. And the only place he gets anything in the way of an African-American vote is with black men, not with black women. So what you saw was a real appeal to black African-Americans, okay, and males. They had to be males. What I think is so interesting is that was happening. Think about this, Scott. What was happening with the sports teams that were deciding not to play because of what was going on in Wisconsin? So it's very, very interesting. These are the competing voices that are looking at African-American men more than anything else. Donald Trump was trying to appeal to them in the RNC convention, and what you saw happening with the sports teams basically making a decision not to play, they were also making an appeal to them, saying, you know what, this is too important. We need to speak up, and we have to stop playing until we see results. That was just, I mean, and to have them happen simultaneously is so interesting.
I think that one of the good things about President Trump's time in office, and you may agree or disagree, but I think that some people who should have always been involved in politics are involved in politics now. And let me tell you a quick story. Years ago, I was covering a lot of education issues in the Houston area, and I was talking to some of the superintendents of schools in some of the big suburban school districts. And one thing that they would say privately, but they didn't want to say publicly because of the controversial nature of this, they would say that a lot of the women who work as teachers and work in education in other roles as well, a lot of the women vote Republican because that's what their husbands do. And they would say that, and the immediate pushback I would get when I would talk about this, especially from Democrats, they would say, oh, Scott, that's real cute. You and these guys think that the women just do what their husbands tell them. But that's not what we're talking about. That wasn't the dynamic. It's not like women are not being told by their husbands how to vote. That would not go over well if that was what was happening. But the dynamic instead was that the women just weren't involved in politics. They didn't think that it involved them. They didn't really care about it. But their husband, who lives in the suburbs outside of Houston or Dallas or whatever, the husband's the one who listens to right-wing talk radio. And of course, he's the one who puts the Republican campaign sign out in the yard. And that's the person that the family is supporting. Nobody's being told how to vote. This is just who they identify with, and they're not arguing with their husband because it's a thing he cares about. I don't care about it. Well, guess what? Women care about it now. They have seen their kids gunned down in schools. They have seen the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. They have seen their own health care be ripped to shreds by the system that we have and the decisions that are made in Austin and Washington, and they're tired of it. And you see women and others getting involved. And that doesn't mean they're going to all naturally vote for Democrats. But what always happens when a new group of people gets involved in politics, and actually our Lieutenant Governor, Little Governor Patrick, has said some version of this, and I think on this he's right. When new people get involved in politics, what you have to do, if you're trying to get elected or get certain people elected, you need to go make your case to that group. And don't take them for granted ever that they're just going to vote for you. Because if you haven't articulated reasons for why you should fire the people who are in charge and hire you instead, then guess what? The people who are in charge have the advantage of incumbency, and they're probably going to stay there unless you get off your laurels and do the work.
Well, I'm just watching the sports teams and having, you know, absolutely no clue to like what's the NBA versus the football league versus the hockey league. I have no idea. But to suddenly see these teams stepping up and doing it in concert, which is just amazing. And the one person I think they should all be calling up right now is Colin Kaepernick.
Sure.
Because I think it's been exactly
4 years ago.
Exactly. And everyone sort of looked at him and look what he did. He didn't do anything except I don't want to go back there, but I want to, before I let you go, I want to talk about Crenshaw one more time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is that, so I think he was smart. He never did the sort of the hostile throw.
You watched his deal.
Throw red meat to his base. Mm-hmm. Is he worried about two things? You talked about how gerrymandered his district is. There is a possibility that the Texas legislature could go blue. That means will be deciding redistricting. He mm-hmm. does not want a piece of tape, especially at the Republican convention, that if he is in a redistricted district and he wants to have a future, he has to get reelected. Has to get reelected or there is no future. So I think he's not only looking at where the Republican Party might be in the future without Donald Trump, he is also looking at what is the possibility of him getting reelected if they tweak his district and it isn't as grotesquely gerrymandered as it was now. And therefore, if he's going to win, he's going to have to win with a more diverse audience and a diverse electorate. And therefore, he doesn't want to do damage to his future.
Well, that's very possible. And I would say this for members of Congress from Texas. I know we have to go in just a second, but for members of Congress, this is especially a tenuous time because if the Democrats take the majority in the Texas House and the House and Texas Senate do not agree on the congressional maps, they go to federal court. And Texas has a long history of having drawn maps that were found by federal courts to be discriminatory. And so the courts would probably draw a very different map.
Right. Thank you so much. All right, Scott Braddock, I'm glad you're safe. Stay healthy. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Scott Braddock writes for the Quorum Report. He's also known as the voice of Texas. We will schmooze next Friday. Thank you so much.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. That was the day miners in Tracy City, Tennessee, rebelled against the state's convict lease system. Miners had been forced to work side by side with convict labor. The convicts, overwhelmingly African American, were forced to live in deplorable stockade conditions. Their presence in the mines served to minimize paid labor, keep wages low, and stunt union organizing throughout the state. Miners demanded that Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad give them the same hours of work as the convicts. When they refused, the miners marched on the stockades where the convicts were housed. They released the convicts and marched them onto trains bound for Nashville, burning the stockades to the ground. The revolt at Tracy City followed armed uprisings of thousands of miners the previous year in nearby Briceville and Coal Creek. Here, it is thought that the Knights of Labor leaders led miners to surround stockades, disarm guards, and release convicts onto Knoxville-bound trains over the course of several days. By August of 1892, hundreds of miners would confront state forces in armed shootouts across Grundy, Marion, and Anderson counties, releasing convicts when they could onto trains bound for Nashville. Miners were eventually arrested and convicted, but these revolts would lead the Tennessee General Assembly to end its convict lease system 4 years later, making them one of the first southern states to do so.
Well, they brought in the entire state militia, heavy artillery and Gatling guns.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The newspaper said they won a great victory, handed out medals for their bravery. They got the convicts out of the mines.
met my enemy today. A baby takes the little one out to play. Enemy shot two of my buddies down. Baby rides the little one on the merry-go-round. By my post I'm standing guard. Baby hopes for roses in the front yard. I don't know my enemy's name. Baby takes the little one to a baseball game. I am in this godforsaken place while baby wipes the dirt from the little one's face. 10 years old in the killing fields, a baby's plan, a weekly meal. Body is in a body ditch. A baby's got a supper to fix. My brother's got a hole in his head. A baby gets the little one ready for bed. Today I shot my enemy. Baby gives the little one a hug for me. Both my buddy's legs got bone on. Baby tends to the little one's call. I stare down at the barrel of a gun. A baby's going out to have some fun. And I hear ringing in my ear. A baby's face is all wet with my body down. And baby rides the little one on a merry-go-round.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other week we grab Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the governorship of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He is a prolific writer. He writes for Salon.com. And he is, as I've said over and over again, one of the most, I think, articulate, aware, knowledgeable political pundits I know, especially when it comes to sort of doing analysis of progressive politics in America, some place where he's always been, and he's sort of watching it maybe coming back. I'm not quite sure, Bill Curry. But before we get into anything that even resembles progressive politics, we do have to acknowledge that this has been the week for the Trump convention. I can't call it the RNC convention. I can't call it the GOP convention. Because it ain't none of those things. It is definitely the Trump convention. And while we are Zooming this show on Thursday morning, we've had at least 3 days of the Trump convention. The one thing I was really kind of interested in was going to be comparing the sort of speech of Michelle Obama to the speech of Melania Trump. And right away, when she walked out there, coming to the Rose Garden, I'm going, wow, check out that outfit. I think I've seen that outfit in a German catalog. Anyway, but right away, I'm kind of, here's what's so interesting. What she is known for is being incredibly feminine. What she is known for is being incredibly colorful. And right from the get-go, I'm thinking, what's the code here? Because look at how she is dressed. And then I was talking to you, and you made some interesting comments about Melania's speech. And I thought, well, this is a perfect segue from the code of the outfit to the code of the content. So welcome to the program, Bill Curry.
Well, thank you. And right back at you, General Dunn, I appreciate it. First of all, as you can tell, we're on Artie and I are talking on a Zoom video right now. And as anyone can tell just looking at me, I am not a fashionista, nor are most of my friends, but I'm surprised at how many people have commented on that outfit to me. I just seldom get a lot of comments about what people were wearing when they gave speeches from my own particular circle, but it apparently hit others. I'm not visual very much in that way, as you can tell. But the speech I was listening to quite closely because I feel that's my job. And what I was really struck by was, you know, I just don't get it. Everything she said in that speech, it reminded me of like the coded message in a hostage video, you know, where everything can be taken one way or another. You know, when she talks about we have to end bullying, we have to be able to trust the honesty of our politicians, we have to be concerned about social justice and the COVID, the extraordinary empathy for the COVID victims, or for that matter, mentioning them at all. And I just thought, you know, after their divorce, which should be sometime early next year, she's going to write a memoir. And the memoir is going to say, weren't any of you listening? You know, I was begging to get across a counter message, and just no one, you know, no one heard me.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, as you say that, I am sort of thinking about Mary Trump. I'm thinking about Donald's sister. I'm thinking about Melania Trump. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what the women know. It's just amazing.
No,
and what they know is that he's a hollow piece of you-know-what.
Yeah.
And he has absolutely no moral compass. He can absolutely not be trusted. And how the hell did you elect him the first time? God help us if you do it again. It's just kind of shocking.
Yes, let me just say, it's too bad that my own gender checked out on the personal and the day-to-dayness of life, or there'd be more witnesses. But you're absolutely correct. If we turn to the women of the Trump family, I'll bet Mary Trump's wasn't the last we'll hear from them.
Oh, I'm completely convinced you're right.
One of the things that the convention has testified to so far, and I've watched all of it.
You are
okay.
So
I know. And then next week, I'm getting a life, okay? But but this week, I watched this stuff. And it's also amazing to me how small his circle now is, how isolated a president or a person really can become. Maybe it's a question of his age. But, you know, the son, the son's girlfriend, the other son, the son's wife, the daughter, all of these people, it's like it's all that you have left. You know, his direct inner employees, the press secretary is giving a speech at the convention. Who ever heard of such a thing? Why was that? Because they can't find anyone else who's compelling to do that.
Everything that he did was probably in violation of the Hatch Act. So we have now seen, you know, things that should have been separate from politics is now sort of marbleized into one. And that actually goes back to your point that he has such a small circle, he employs them all. That's all that's left.
And the reason
why you had to go to Jerusalem.
That's a wonderful point.
And that's all that's left. He had no choice. He had no choice. It had to take place at the White House. It had to take place in Jerusalem. It had to take place. I mean, think about that. And that's why everyone is confused by the fact that there is no line of demarcation. There is no line of demarcation because the circle of friends is so tiny that was the only way he could pull it off. And it looks stature enhancing. But it's actually depressing.
It is depressing. And by the way, one last thing I'll add is if you're going to have Eric's wife, who really gave one of the most abysmal speeches at a convention in my memory. If she's speaking, I just have one question, and maybe I have missed something, but where's Jared? Where's Jared? And again, you know, it was really, actually, it was a really brilliant observation on your part. I want to really underscore it. And that is that I said that he only had family members left to testify on his behalf. And you basically said, yes, he only has family members in his employ left to testify on his behalf.
Yes.
And but Jared is so radioactive at this point and makes such an awful impression, I think, that he is, of all of them, apparently the most influential within that nutball White House. So far not there, and there's no signal. I don't see him on the schedule for this last evening either. So.
Yeah. And it is quite shocking, since he basically has the assignment to do everything. There is, I mean, the Middle East, he's got the assignment for COVID. He's got, I mean, there isn't anything on his plate. So maybe it's totally appropriate that he not be there.
He's still, by the way, he's still in charge of quite literally cleaning up the swamp and modernizing the bureaucracy. That was his first big assignment. You know, if they could just give him 5 minutes to give us an update on how that's going, that would be a highlight of my convention. Anyway, having said all this, I just want to say, it is hard for me to watch this engage its impact on others. I do recoil from Trump so viscerally, and so, as so many of us do. I recoil from his profound dishonesty and misogyny and race baiting and incompetence and corruption, all of it. He's the most repulsive figure in American politics in my lifetime, maybe ever. And therefore, when one of his people is doing well at the convention, or when it's going over with those swing voters that we, you know, still must worry about, no election will ever be simply a matter of getting your base out. It will always be a matter also of educating people who are undecided. It's hard for me to stress that, let alone reach a conclusion. And so anyway, I don't know. Some of this may be working. And it is incumbent upon Democrats. I'll tell just a two-sentence anecdote. It is the very young George Stephanopoulos coming out of the 1988 Dukakis disappointment, in which Willie Horton and the Boston Harbor ads were so untrue and so unfair and so effective. And Stephanopoulos said then, I'd only met him once, then it was a long, long time ago, and he said, what Democrats have learned from this election is never, ever to let a charge go unrefuted.
Yes.
Ever again. I look at the years since, and I think it is very clear that George himself learned that lesson. But it's not clear to me that many other Democrats have. I still don't think we do anything close to what we need to do of calling out each lie. If they tell a lie 500 times and they understand the value of repetition, we have to at least refute it 20 times, you know? We have to get out there, and we have to not just call it a lie. We have to expose a lie. Calling it a lie gets you almost nothing. It just drags you into the same mud. Exposing the lie gets you everything. There's nothing better in a campaign than a rebuttal ad that effectively reveals the dishonesty of a smear. That is political gold to a candidate in a tight race.
So No. You're hitting me in a place where I'm incredibly vulnerable, and let me tell you why. I used to do commercial radio. And what I loved about commercial radio was that there was variety in commercial radio. So you would go from a Rush Limbaugh to an Arnie Arneson, or you would go from an Arnie Arneson to a Sean Hannity, but there was variety, you know, the Dr. Ruth, whoever. So I learned from my conservatives. Now, what I learned from my conservatives is the power of repetition. Right. And so if there was a misstatement, or if there was a fact that people knew, I could talk about that fact on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday, in order for my audience, because people learn through repetition. You know that. Well, here's what happened. Commercial radio drained people like me off the dial. I am no longer a voice on commercial radio. What replaced the Arnie Arnesons was public radio. Here is the problem with public radio. They are very smart. Jimmy Carter was very smart. Michael Dukakis was very smart. What they basically assumed was you would just revel in their intellect. Well, what the Republicans decided to do was take their lies, repeat them thousands and thousands of times. Rush Limbaugh is the personification of that. He repeats lives 3 hours a day, 5 days a week on hundreds, if not thousands, of stations. NPR is very intellectual. NPR doesn't repeat. Oh, we discuss that on Monday. We don't have to discuss it on Tuesday. Oh, this is the fact. But the fact is told once, as if that one time you tell the fact, that will somehow be strong enough to fight the thousands of lies that are repeated thousands of times, now not only out of the mouth of Rush Limbaugh, now out of the mouth of the president. And what the Democrats haven't learned to do is they haven't learned to not only fight that, but understand their power of repetition. They think somehow that that's something that they should disdain. Well, I hate to break it to you, they can.
No one can. And it is the one tactic of totalitarian propagandists,
yes,
that their opponents must adopt. You have to be willing to tell the truth as often as they lie.
Exactly.
That shouldn't be that hard an assignment.
No.
And the second thing is specificity and concreteness when you do it. I'll just give one example. I've heard at least 1,000 times in the last year or two, probably more, a Republican crowing about the number of regulations they've repealed. Mm-hmm. I've never heard a Democrat say, I want you to stop and think about the regulations they're talking about.
Yes!
What they've
yes!
done.
I love you.
And every time they say they've deregulated, I want you to know that it's to allow coal and other industries to leach poisons into the water that your children swim in and sometimes drink.
Right.
It is to pollute the air. It is to make us pay all the externalized costs of their production. That there is almost nothing in this that's good for you as a consumer, a worker, or even an investor. But to make it human, Trump and his cohort are so much better at describing a crime wave in the streets that is nearly non-existent almost everywhere than we are at describing an actual wall of water engulfing Texas and Louisiana, and of connecting it simply to the fact that now everyone understands that there's no explanation except climate change. It's now down to Occam's razor. You know, it's the simplest and most obvious explanation. And it's time to act on it. I was about to say before it's too late. I don't know if it's too late. And I'm happy that Bill McKibben and other people I admire so much never come out and say it's too late. I often wonder what they really think. But we have to believe that it's not too late to avert the worst consequences. And to see this, all the horrible damage, to see what it does, it truly threatens the survival of our species, but it knocks our economy and our budgets, our public sector budgets out completely. And it just, already, it's like the neutron bomb. For government budgets and for much of business.
So Bill Carter,
where are we on getting that across?
Well, so I spoke with Dean Baker, who is an economist, mm-hmm. and one of the things I asked him, I said, so Dean, let's say that Joe Biden wins. What's the first thing you would do to repair the economy? What do we need to do? What do we need to reinstate taxes? Do we need to raise the minimum wage? You know what he said? You need to deal with the pandemic. And
sure,
so I
absolutely.
Said, wait. So here's what I said. I said, I want the Democrats to say over and over again, the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. It is. It is. And if you somehow think that you are going to bring jobs back, help small business, return frontline workers to the original job they were doing as opposed to the jobs that they're doing now, if you don't deal with the pandemic, there is no economy. And that means that testing and vaccines and treatments and all those things have to be dealt with and dealt with aggressively. And we have to connect it. It is not just a health issue. It is actually the economy. And he was like, oh my God. I said, but we don't say that. So we let Donald Trump talk about the economy as if so, because he marginalizes the pandemic, which we begin to realize now is killing even more people. Did you realize at UNC, 31% of the students at UNC tested positive for COVID? 31%. That's unbelievable when you begin to realize what that means as a consequence. So again, we need to connect the dots. We need to make it real. And we need to explain to people, until you aggressively deal with this, unemployment's, you know, going to be skyrocketing, and you are going to be teaching your kids at home because there is no such thing as school.
First of all, there's no question at all. Simply, I agree entirely. That simple formulation there is only one economic revival strategy, and that is to end this pandemic.
Yes.
And everything that Trump has done has been geared toward the opposite idea that you can revive the economy without taking government action. And there's no country in the world that has done this effectively without effective national government action. There is no other way. There is no other way, period. And I don't understand it. And to go back to climate change, just for a second, to put into this, I would just say this. In climate change, you know, if you were to take the trajectory of COVID and compare it to the longer historical trajectory of climate change, say from 1990 on, it's already late March, early April. You know, this is the virus is spreading. It's everywhere. There are two things to say about it. The first is that its effects on human health. I talked before about fiscal effects, economic effects, human health and mortality is vastly greater than COVID.
Yes.
The effect of climate change on human health includes starvation. It includes mass drought. It includes coastal cities all over the world being evacuated in chaos in many cases. It includes wars over resources. What is coming here is a kind of chaos for which the Trump years are simply a metaphor. It has to be averted. It is late and it is imminent. The second thing is that the value of acting here is indispensable. All Americans, all people who pay attention to voting, left or right, have the memory that the United States did really well from the information technology boom, that American companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, we led the world, our scientists did, and then our entrepreneurs did, and we profited mightily from it. In fact, lots of other things happened, the loss of privacy and the loss of jobs being the first two that come to mind that no one talked much about in the 90s. But it was an enormous change. The change to sustainable economics based on renewable energy and conservation is even greater in its economic effect. It is the key. It's not a choice between the environment and in jobs. It never was. This is the key. And instead of leading this crest, we're behind it already, well behind. Even 10, 15 years ago, we led the world in the production of environmental technologies, but we're only 9th or 10th, I think actually 12th, I think, in export proportionally. That's because none of us really got, none of our leaders got the importance of it. You know, we weren't developing, we weren't paying attention to it. This is the key. Localization, distribution, distributive energy, small scale, renewable, this is localized agriculture, localized energy production. This is our future. It is staring at us, and we will not embrace it.
And you know what?
Democrats have to come out and say that, and the country has to be saying it every day. This is the change we have to make now, and it's all good. You know, was it Maslow or Carl Rogers? The facts are friendly. You know, the facts are friendly. This is all good if we just act.
And on top of that, so you're talking about the sort of the pandemic of climate change. So we have the pandemic itself. We now have a pandemic of racism, and then we have the pandemic of climate change. What to me is so fascinating is, as I said at the beginning, the pandemic is the economy. So let's go to what we know about climate change. Climate change is the economy too. But here's the beauty of alternative energy and sustainability, and that is that it's actually also a pay raise. If you combat climate change, you're giving Americans a pay raise. Because if they are able to do alternative energy like solar, like wind, alternative energies are actually an increase in folks' paychecks. That's
no
what
question.
These are.
It's also, by the way, if you think about what the model ought to be, and I've written about this, but I haven't published, but the model for how we put more disposable income into people's pockets is not going to be from dramatic wage increases. That's really the truth. That's what globalization means. But we can put as much new money in people's pockets today as we did in the post-World War II boom by lowering the cost of the basic necessities of life, by lowering the cost of healthcare, by lowering the cost of energy, by lowering the cost of credit, by making a tax structure which is less regressive at state and local as well as federal levels. We can put an enormous amount of money into the pockets of the people who need it most by the kinds of transitions we need to make systemically. Mm-hmm. Hey, I just want to switch gears for 1 second if we could here at the end, and that is just that we haven't spoken yet, as we meant to, about what's happening in policing and public safety.
Right.
And it goes to the same things that we're saying about these other things in many ways. And that is, again, whether it's climate change or foreign policy or crime in the streets, Democrats have been punched drunk from 40 years of being battered by the right on issues like this. And so they're too fearful of coming out and saying what they believe and explaining what's happening. But secondly, also, that they need to reach out to the political center, not to the political establishment, not to, you know, not to the corporate lobbyists, not to the fossil fuel or defense or any of the other industries that run the government now, but they do need to reach out to their neighbors. And the first promise any politician makes to people is to keep them safe. And we have to be willing to bring up proactively one that, not just as an aside while talking about the larger moral issues that concern us on this issue, but we have to bring up our commitment to keeping the streets safe. And that involves letting people know that we're tough on looters, okay? That looters and people who bring violence are not part of our coalition. And we need to help people find the right strategies to deal with it. And I'll just point out that secondly, that means, you know, I keep thinking of Gandhi, who fasted because there was violence in the streets to the point of death. Yeah. And our inability, when I listen to the Republicans citing Martin Luther King multiple times, we need to cite Martin Luther King's message of peace. And we need to talk to these violent elements, not just to disassociate ourselves. We can, as soon as we've done that, as soon as we've told people emphatically, proactively, that we're committed to public safety, we can then begin to talk about, you know, what I ran in 1994, a platform we called, I think we borrowed this phrase from the Brits, but tough on crime, tough on its causes, and dealing with the underlying systemic problems in the society, including race, but also social justice in other aspects. We need to commit to doing this stuff specifically.
Bill Curry joins us every other week. I need to let him go. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. Please join us soon.
If you ever do run for office again, I'd be happy to come up and do a little door-to-door.
All right, it's a deal. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you. Next. Ciao. You better-